For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Live from a bunker in the heart of the Ozarks, a podcast that's not smart, but at least we're also not that handsome. It's Sif Pop. Welcome to Sif Pop Weekly, streaming live most Fridays, are available to download later in your podcast feed, unless, of course, you're a patron.
Patrons get perks.
Patrons get those perks. Woo! I'm your host, Aaron Dicer, and he makes me wait till his heart rate is under 60 before starting the podcast. It's Andrew Ormsby, ladies and gentlemen.
I wish I had a resting heart rate of under 60. Ahoy!
Each week we'll chat about movies, TV, and whatever else from the pop culture universe is on our minds. 54, my friend. I'm down to 54 for my resting heart rate.
Everybody in my family has a super fast heart rate. It's genetic.
Yeah.
Like mid-80s.
Wow! That's wild. That is a very high resting heart rate for most people. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's wild. Yeah, I think.
And because, on top of that, I got a bipolar disorder, so.
So the anxiety part probably. So
the anxiety can kick that up to the high of 120s.
Adds a few notches. Yes, I am a giant man and also very laid back and also just started running again recently, which actually my resting heart rate has dropped six beats in the last 3 weeks from running.
Hell so yeah,
it'll happen that way. So yeah, good time, good conversations about resting heart rates. That's what people came that's what people came here to listen to, for sure.
You know it.
We're going to talk about a couple of killer movies this week. Killers of the Flower Moon and The Killer, both in
so much murder. So much murder.
Both are in theaters right now, and then will be on their relative streaming services here pretty shortly. Killers of the Flower Moon going to end up on Apple TV Plus, and The Killer going to end up on Netflix, but doing limited runs in theaters currently. So we're going to go ahead and chat about them.
Still doing limited runs in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
I know, at first I thought it was, you know, a COVID thing, like a pandemic thing. But no, it seems like, you know, these streaming services, they're liking this idea of a limited release in theaters.
Yeah, and some of it's awards based, you know, making sure to get awards eligibility and those kind of things. But yeah, I think there's a little bit of money to be made as well. So they're probably eager to do that. We're also going to do a best ever challenge. Get this, best ever killer movies. That's right. Movies with the word kill, killer, killing, some form of the word kill in the title. We will do that. And of course, we'll do some buried treasure at the end. No reason to dilly dally, though. Andrew, let's get into it. Let's kick it off with Martin Scorsese's latest, Killers of the Flowered Moon.
The Osage took their name from Missouri and Osage Rivers. Neukanska. Children of the Middle Waters. Move, said the great white father. There are many, so many hungry wolves. Can you find the wolves in this picture?
When oil is discovered in 1920s Oklahoma under Osage Nation land, the Osage people are murdered one by one until the FBI steps in to unravel the mystery. Killers of the Flower Moon, I believe, was a book first. Martin Scorsese looked to adapt it into a screenplay or have someone adapt it into a screenplay. Leonardo DiCaprio, I believe, was originally slated to play the head of the FBI and went to Martin Scorsese and said, I think this is a little too FBI-centric. I think we need to be more Osage-centric. And so they agreed on that and eventually gave us the script that we have and gave Martin Scorsese one of his first screenplay credits in a while because he wrote some of the revision on the new screenplay. So yeah, got Leo in there, got De Niro in his first ever Scorsese movie. It's nice to see those two working together finally. It's been, you know,
finally
everybody's been wanting it for a long time. It's good to see it finally happen. And then many others stopping by as well. What did you think? Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay?
I really liked it. Close to loved it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. In fact, I'm going to say I loved it. Okay. I think that's because the negatives, they just aren't enough to offset the incredible positives that I had coming out of this movie. I will start by saying that the last three Scorsese movies, I believe, Silence, The Irishman, and then Killers of the Flower Moon. Those are the last three, right? I have loved all three of those movies. And I think there's something that he has like wrestled with and is finding a way in his movies to like mature in some interesting ways that appeal to me specifically. I think he's understanding the ramifications of the violence a little bit more in the stories he's telling. And it's, I don't know, it's really interesting to see him as he, is he in his 80s or approaching his 80s? I know he's
in his 80s.
Yeah, I think he's up there in the, you know, getting towards that Clint Eastwood territory. And I'm just so so glad
1942.
He's doing this. If he was in 42, then yes, he is 81 right now. So yeah, I'm excited for all the time we have left with Marty and what he might bring us, because I've really, really enjoyed the last three outings. And I think probably the biggest thing that puts me from like to love is Lily Gladstone in the portrayal of Molly Burkhart. There is something so uniquely steady about this performance that just speaks volumes. And I left this movie moved by that character's stillness in the face of absolute torture and trauma. And even that character's, I think there's some interesting conversations to be had about what is forgiveness, what is grace, what is love, baby don't hurt me, wait, no, is that how the song goes? I don't know. But there's a lot of interesting conversations to be had about that kind of stuff, and I think a lot of that centers on the beauty of the Lily Gladstone performance. So yeah, I took a lot from this, had a lot of really interesting conversations with my wife after we watched it, and was just really excited to kind of process my way through it. What about you? What are some of your feelings? I know you really liked it as well.
Yeah. Well, you know, whenever I start off my first pro and it's not about a performance, then it must be something really impressive.
Sure.
So this week, Rodrigo Pietro, the director of photography for this film, is who I am giving the MVP award, because this is an absolutely stunner of a film. He's worked with Scorsese a lot. I think he's been with Scorsese, at least I know, all the way back till Wolf of Wall Street, maybe even before.
Mm-hmm.
Just an absolute gorgeous film, and there's enough of it to be gorgeous. So, yeah, I think that a lot of people go into what you were talking about earlier with why you think that you possibly liked this film a little bit more than a lot of other Scorsese. Mm-hmm. I think I have an idea why.
Sure.
And I think it's because I think people are going to appreciate Scorsese, this film of his, more because opposed to his other films, this one focuses more on the victims of violence rather than glorification that you would normally see in his other pieces of work. This one is all about victim mentality as opposed to this is still a gangster film. Don't get me wrong. All of his films are gangster films, but I think that this one focuses more on the ramifications and the collateral damage of gang life than a lot of his other films do.
Yeah, I think I always hesitate to use the word glorification with Scorsese because
that's why I did the air quotes, but I guess you can't see that on the podcast.
I get and I get it. I understand that for some people that's what they mean is like, oh, this makes violence look, you know, glorified. It's not a glorification necessarily. It's that there's an exuberance to it, there's an energy to it that is very easily, and I feel intentionally, interpreted as excitement, not sadness or trauma or, you know, those kind of things. And so I know that's semantics in some ways, but I do like to distinguish because I don't think Scorsese's intent was ever to be like, violence, yay! You know, I just think his intent was to be that he... to show the enthrallment in the gravity of the violent worlds, right? And how that can be personified. And I know that's a slight distinction, but it's one I do like to make. But I agree with you. The cinematography on this is outstanding. The way this movie captures things from the first shot to the last is so artistic. There are brilliant artistic decisions made story-wise that I think are interesting visually and structurally as well. So, yeah, there's a lot of really interesting choices and work being done in that way in this movie. I also want to give a shout-out in regards to that creativity with the movie's choice on how to end things. In this, and there's kind of a 1-2 punch, so to speak, of endings. One that involves a cut to a completely different entertainment style at the end, and then a coda with a drone shot that I just thought was lovely way to honor the ending. But the different entertainment styles, so to speak, I'm trying not to spoil. I'm trying to walk around spoilers.
The penultimate ending.
Yes, the penultimate stuff. I found really bold and not capricious. Yeah. I really felt like it was meaningful and specifically done as a way to say it is hard to tell these stories when it is not your own story. It is hard to tell these stories without feeling exploitative. And it was almost in some ways a mea culpa at the end from Scorsese himself to be able to say, I know I'm not necessarily the person who can tell this perfectly, but I had to tell this story. You know what I mean? Like there's a real interesting choice being made there that I think works.
It reminded me a lot of, we talked about this a couple weeks ago, how Wes Anderson knows how to break things down to the story of it all.
Yes.
And I think that ending, that penultimate ending in this film, is Martin Scorsese's version of giving you his idea. It all comes down to the story itself. The way it was broken down from seeing an actual, you know, regular movie that, you know, we experienced for 3 hours and 10 minutes to automatically shift and be broken down like that. It reminded me so much of what Wes Anderson was doing. And that's not something I'd ever think I would say, hey, you know what Wes Anderson reminds me of? Martin Scorsese.
Yeah. Not often in the same sentence. But yeah, I can see what you're saying there. Let's talk about a few of the other performances. I think De Niro's great. I think DiCaprio's great. I don't think we would expect anything less. Like, I don't know that either of them blow my expectations out of the water, but my expectations are super high when I watch these people on film. So, that's not really saying a lot. Jesse Plemons does continue to blow my expectations out of the water. I love.
You went toe to toe with DiCaprio.
Yeah. And I've been so impressed with his choices and his ability. I mentioned Lily Gladstone. I do think she's the best performance in the film, doing amazing stuff. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it's restrained her performance, yet at the same time, whenever there are emotional beats that she can just... She can tug at the heartstrings like in ways that I haven't felt in a very long time. It just felt so real and visceral.
Mm-hmm.
We always, in my acting class, we always did something called psychosomatic training,
mm-hmm.
where you would, you know, imagine something and you would try and convince yourself over and over again it was real to help you really immerse yourself into the scene or into your performance. And that is what that reminded me of. Like, not method acting, like, but maybe she did, but she drew upon something to make it seem so real. Like, every time she had to experience a loss, it was so genuine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just completely believable and a real counterpoint to the other energy of the movie, right? Like, her energy is such a counterpoint to the DiCaprio or De Niro performance, and I think it works really, really well, and very much a counterpoint to the Brendan Fraser performance, which is
doth think the Brendan Fraser protests too much.
it's so over the top. Like, I'm still debating, like, is it good, is it not good? I kind of think it's not good, but like, I don't think it's good.
I want it to be good.
This is one of those experiences. I want it to be good.
I do too. That was actually one of my cons I did write down. I'm like, I don't know if Brendan Fraser was being asked to do that,
mm-hmm.
to be that over the top,
you, or if that was just dumb his boy. Whatever he says.
Yeah. You dumb boy.
I mean, it may be based on the way that lawyers of that time, you know, did their thing. I don't know. It just it struck me as less authentic than everything else that was going on around it, and that may just be my perspective. So, but anyways,
well, everybody else was so restrained, and here you have the Kool-Aid man kicking in the door. Oh yeah.
Yeah, John Lithgow shows up for a cup of coffee as the opposing attorney, and mm-hmm. That's always good to see Lithgow on screen. And any other performances you wanted to mention aside from those?
Lily Gladstone is the big one that I'm going to mention here.
I
would probably also mention... Oh, sorry. I was going to mention... where is he at? Louis Cancelmi.
Mm-hmm.
He was a... I know creepy, him from Billions. Dude.
He's been on Billions for a few seasons, and I enjoy him on Billions. Yeah,
never seen that show. Probably should.
It's a lot of fun. I think you would enjoy it. It's the final season this season. So,
okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, I thought he was great in his matter of fact sociopathy.
Cold. It was just.
Yeah.
It was bump given.
Jason Isbell. Who you may know as a musical artist, I also found really compelling in this for whatever reason. And then a lot of the other actors like Larry Sellers and many of the other native actors, I just the amount of gravitas they bring to those conversations, it's so beautiful and so valuable. And I wanted to mention them as well. Yeah, it's full of good performances. It's full of interesting moments. I think when you start to talk about negatives, one of the big ones for a lot of people will be the length of the film. It is long. I mean, it is 6 minutes shorter than The Irishman. So, you know, so it can't be too long. In fact, the three movies I talked about are all 3.5 hour movies. Silence is also
Silence.
So I just think that's what Marty does now. He just doesn't want to edit as much.
And far be it from me to tell Martin Scorsese how to make a film, but I do think it is a little bit too long.
That's
just me. It's a personal preference.
Yeah.
And
for it's one me, we both if you're going to make a,
yeah, but for me, it's, if you're going to make a movie like this, it needs a little bit more intensity. It's why I can watch Gangs of New York, another Martin Scorsese movie that's over 3 hours long. I've seen the movie, I don't even know how many times, over 10 times. And it knows when to raise the tempo in the action and when to take its time. Killers of the Flower Moon is not Gangs of New York. It likes to take its time. I'd say a good portion of the film is just scenes of characters simply living in moments.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sure. beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. But in the end, you can't leave this film without having felt the runtime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you don't want the audience to feel it, and I think you do feel it, and I think even more specifically, and I often say if you're going to complain about how long something is, then you need to specifically talk about what could have been taken out, because otherwise, you know, yes. you're if you liked everything that was in there, it's almost hypocritical to say it was too long, right? I think there are a lot of things that Scorsese chooses to do here, and I think I get the intent of them, but he will. You know the old saying, show, don't tell? And the old video saying, like, for exposition, for whatever, show, don't tell. Don't have characters, just say it. Show us what happened. Scorsese does something in this movie that I like to call tell, then show. And so there's a lot of repeating things that happen. So you will hear a character talk about what happened during a certain point or whatever, and then an entire another scene will happen where you see it happen, and it's like, I don't know that I needed the tell if you were going to give me the show. But again I think I understand what he's attempting to do, but I do think that's part of what extends the movie to be longer than it felt. This one felt like it needed to be, in my opinion. So yeah. Totally. Anything else? Any other negatives, positives you wanted to chat about with KOTFM?
This would be a general thought, not pro nor con, but I'm hearing a lot of people say that they found DiCaprio's character, Ernest, to be conflicting in their mind. They felt conflicted about this character.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a pro. Really?
Yeah.
Well, my general thing is I felt no such qualms about how to feel about this guy at all. He's a layered character, but I didn't feel conflicted by how I was supposed to feel about him in any way at all.
Can I tell you what I think people are feeling, and this is what I'm talking about. I think the movie does an absolutely astounding job, and Lily Gladstone does an absolutely astounding job of getting us to see Ernest through her eyes. Right?
Mm.
The empathy that we have for Ernest almost solely comes because we love Molly so much. And the way that Molly gives him the grace to continue to be a terrible human being, like, is just, it's not only fascinating, it's compelling, and it's conflicting. That's where I think the conflicting is coming from. I don't think there's a... I think anybody who watches this movie comes away going, you know what, Ernest was a terrible human being. Like we're all on the same page, right?
Yeah.
It's just, there's, because of the way Molly sees him and also the way the movie sees him, we also come away going, he's kind of a blank slate for whoever in his life to write on, right? Like there's a matter where he's being manipulated through so much of the movie by these people, and it's almost like manipulated by one side and loved by the other, and where is the real power and what is really important, and I don't know that the movie has a clear answer on that. So I think that's where the conflicted part comes from. I could be wrong, but that's it's one of my favorite parts of the movie, is processing those things, you know, what is this movie saying about, you know, loving those who harm you or who you suspect are harming you, or, you know, like up until the very end, you feel like she wants to give him a chance to be the person she thinks he can be, you know?
And that's why she asked him that last question.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Up until the very end.
Yeah.
And so I think it's part of the sadness of the movie, but I also think it's part of the strength of the movie as well. So it's definitely worth talking about, I think.
Yeah, I found him a layered character and complicated, but I was just never conflicted on how I was supposed to feel about him.
Right. It's hard to be conflicted on in the way you're talking about on a character that makes some of the choices that his character makes. So,
but ooh, great performance.
Yep.
Yeah. Transformative.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I'm beginning to think Leo might be a decent actor.
Yep.
Could be the case. Award season. What do you see happening with this movie?
Lily Gladstone, Rodrigo Pietro. It's funny because I was looking up, I'm like, man, whoever did Barbie is going to give Rodrigo Pietro a run for their money. it's Rodrigo Pietro. He was the director of photography for Barbie as well. Because, like, man, the it's such a well-shot movie. So, yeah, I think that this might be his year, regardless of which one he gets nominated for.
Nice. Or both. Maybe he'll split his own votes. Why not? Actors have been nominated in the same category in multiple roles.
Oh.
Right?
Would have thought it. I can't think of it ever happening, but I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying I don't know.
Maybe it hasn't happened. Maybe I'm thinking Critics' Choice. I'm almost sure in Critics' Choice it's happened, but but I could be wrong. I don't think there's anything stating it can't happen. I just think usually they will campaign for, you know, one or the other.
One. Okay, that makes sense.
Anything else you wanted to talk about?
After 3.5 hours, there better not be a post-credit scene. If you haven't said everything you wanted to say.
Yeah. Yeah, there's kind of a pre-credit scene, right? Like that ultimate ending that I talked about with the drone shot is it's the end of the movie, but it feels almost like a tag in some ways. But I really like it. I think the only other thing I will say about the movie, and I'll finish with this, it does feel like a movie that is battling itself in some parts, in that it wants to be a movie from the Osage perspective, but its central characters are still the evil white guys, right? Like it kind of wants to have it both way. And I think you feel it the strongest once the FBI gets involved, because then you've got the good, mostly white guys against the bad white guys. And you know what I'm saying? Like, and so there's the movie kind of feels it crossed purposes, I think, especially for the last third of the movie. And I do think the movie suffers for that a little bit, but it's still, I think, beautiful and about as well as Scorsese could have done it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
Also, it's a fun historical. I learned a lot in this movie too.
Yeah, I don't know that I'd
not
say
from
fun,
watching the movie, but also from like afterwards. I was looking up, like learning about the Osage people and stuff like that.
Yeah,
like, yeah, it's fascinating.
It fits really well. I know they pepper in some Tulsa race riot stuff in there as well, and it fits really well with that story. They're very similar stories from the same time of what happens in a white racist country when a minority race starts to have money and power. And it's just like, nope, not in my country. And I will be evil to make sure it doesn't happen. So, yeah, it's a very similar kind of thing going on. And I think the historical revelation of both of those stories over the last few years through pop culture has been very important for a lot of people to start to wrestle with legacy and history and what the truth is about the sins of the country. So yeah, it's good stuff. All right, there's Killers of the Flower Moon. We'll keep going. Let's talk a little bit about The Killer without the flowers or the moon.
I find music a useful distraction. A focus tool. Keeps the inner voice from wandering. This is what it takes. My process is purely logistical. If I'm effective, it's because of one simple fact. I don't give a
After a fateful near miss, an assassin battles his employers and himself on an international manhunt he insists isn't personal. He insists it isn't personal. This is David Fincher's latest film. And if you know anything about David Fincher, you know that he likes to explore the inner workings of the murderer's mind, whether it be Zodiac or Mindhunter, or now The Killer, as well as many others. Even you look at like Fight Club and Seven, and you know he's definitely likes, or Dragon Tattoo. That's kind of his jam. So, what did you think about the Killer, Andrew? Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay?
Low side of okay.
Andrew, we are simpatico this week. I am also on the low side of okay. And
it's a Fincher movie.
I
maybe that's what it is. I had such high expectations for
this. Yeah,
because it's Fincher.
There is an expectation thing that goes along with it. I agree. But the movie, I don't think the movie is doing what the movie thinks it's doing. And I think that becomes a difficult thing. I'm going to let you start on this one since I started on the last one. What are some of your thoughts on The Killer?
I think that the movie is very hypocritical in its messaging of you, or not messaging, but in its tone with this character.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because you have
expound.
A character who, yeah, you have this character who is always, you know, it's a narrative driven film. Like you hear him doing a voiceover for the entire film and he's always talking about being cold, calculated, meticulous. Yet everything that we're seeing from him is being driven by passion, revenge, you know, and it kind of makes sense as to why he's listening to the Smiths. They're a very hypocritical band and now you have a very hypocritical person. But, that's my biggest hang up for it. But the pros, here's the pros.
Okay, let's stop. Since you started there, let's address this a little bit. I know exactly what you're talking about. I had the exact same thought. I, however, think it's probably a positive. Like I think it's intentional. Like I don't think that's a mistake. I think what Fincher is saying is this is a human being who is not. He actually is not his own self-narrative. He has a self-narrative that does not match who he actually is. And then the movie is about him slowly realizing who he really is. And that's why by the end, without giving anything away, he actually says the opposite. Like his last few lines are the exact opposite of his first few lines. And I think it's because we're supposed to believe he is coming to terms with, you know, that he had a false narrative about himself. Does that make sense?
It does, but for me, they never explicitly say that.
No, they don't.
It leaves it to where it feels like it's an empty movie. Like, I don't know, like, what I'm supposed to take away from this film.
Yes,
now.
Yes, I agree. And we can go further into that down the road as well. But go ahead with some of your positives.
Positives. Fincher knows how to build tension.
Mm-hmm.
Like he is very patient with his scenes. He doesn't rush into the action sequences. He lives in the moments and it just works. That first sequence when they're in Paris, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just waiting in that room. I mean, that is up there with like Tarantino, the bunker scene in
right.
Inglourious Basterds, you know, he's just perfect tension building.
The ranch scene, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, the ranch scene. A lot of Tarantino knows how to build tension, and I think that Fincher does as well. You can see that from all of his movies like Seven. And mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that he really knows how to build tension.
Well, he's so technically proficient at using visuals, cutting, and other things.
Kind of sounds like an assassin, doesn't he?
Yes, to be able to bring you into a place. There's a mail delivery that happens in that opening scene that is the most tension filled mail delivery I've ever seen in my life. Like it's and I've seen some tension filled mail deliveries, let me tell you. But it's really impressive how he uses all of the tools to own the audience. Great directors know how to own an audience, and David Fincher knows how to own an audience. I think the trick is, and I'll just say this because we've already touched on it, and then we'll go back to some other thoughts. The trick is to own an audience for a purpose. And if you get to the end of being owned and you can't figure out why they owned you, then you're still
you feel
left.
Used.
Then you feel used, right? Yeah, you feel dissatisfied. You feel used, and that may be a little bit of what's happening here. I will say part of the equation, and maybe my favorite thing about the movie, that again I was very close to even saying I didn't like, but I am going to go with just okay. is the sound design. The sound design in this movie is insane. It's so cool. And it's used so expertly to indicate things. An unbalanced mind, an earbud that's only in one ear. And so like all the music, when you hear it from their POV, is only on one side of the theater. You know, like it's like that kind of stuff is really interesting and cool. And there are these short circuiting sounds that Fincher uses throughout this movie, I think to indicate both that this man's brain ain't all right. And also that this man's brain is in conflict with itself. And there is even towards the end a visual like flinching that represents kind of a similar thing, like a twitch that happens with our main character. We haven't even mentioned Fassbender's name. How did you think Fassbender was in this role?
Yeah, I like Fassbender a lot. I think that he is one of the underrated actors in Hollywood. I think that he needs to be given a lot more roles. I think that he would have been the best Agent 47, like hitman we could have gotten, because I think that this was as close to a good hitman movie as we could have gotten. But the character, he nailed the cold, calculated, meticulous killer. I never bought into the vengeful, passionate rage hellbent. Like I know that the movie made me want to feel that because, you know, he's going John Wick on all these people. But so that's another thing. That catalytic moment. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I don't want to interrupt your stream of consciousness. But I will just say that I think the movie's intent is, again, that cold, calculated part is the lie and that the passion part is real. So the fact that you are watching and going, no, the cold calculating part works for me, that feels authentic, but the passion part doesn't feel authentic, I think is a failure on the movie's part, because I don't think that's the intent. I think the intent is to reverse that.
Yeah, totally. And maybe it's the fact that this catalyst, the reason why, not his accident, I'm talking about what happens to somebody else.
Yes.
That sending him off on this hell hath no fury, like a Fassbender scorned.
Like a hitman scorned.
Like a hitman scorned, exactly. That didn't do it for me. It didn't do it for me. Because if this passionate, rage-filled guy is supposed to be in there, and I'm supposed to believe it, you got to show me something in those moments. Because he's doing so well for me, at least in those cold, calculated moments, that if I were to ever see a human being on that screen, I would have been shocked. Because I would have been like, oh, so is that who the movie's supposed to make me think he is?
I think the movie wants us to believe that he manages the exterior but cannot manage the interior. And that's a difficult thing to portray. I think on an exterior basis, He is the person who he says he is, because that's acting. Acting is exterior, right? It's taking it's taking what is true on the inside and hiding it and making something else true on the outside, or it's like convincing yourself that something that isn't true on the inside is true on the inside, so then it comes out on. It's like, you know, acting theory. We can talk about it in a whole bunch of different ways, but in this case, I think the exterior is what he wants. He looks cold and calculating and whatever, but internally he's realizing that's not who he is. And it's kind of from the beginning, like even in the first scene, there are a couple moments where he will say something like, I always wait until my heart rate is here until I do this. And then actually he doesn't.
No, he doesn't.
He doesn't. And I think
for being as cold and calculated, he makes a lot of mistakes.
I think the movie is giving us that hint right from the beginning. And I want to love the movie for that. I want to respect the movie because I think that's interesting. Like, that's an interesting idea. I just don't know that it goes anywhere that's interesting. I just don't know that by the end of it, I go, oh, I'm glad I took that journey for this reason, this reason, and this reason. I go, what was the point of that? Like, what am I, like,
no, that's other, exactly it. What is the point of that?
Yeah. Yeah. And there are many people who watch movies differently than I do. There are many, many people who don't need the movie to have a point. They can watch a movie and just go, that's a story I had fun watching, right? And I'm not even just saying on a visual level. I'm saying, wow, that's an interesting character that I just watched. It doesn't have to have, at the end of the day, a point. I am a point-based moviegoer. Like, it's just how I watch movies. And so if I get to the end and I go, what am I supposed to take away from this? That's a negative experience for me. But it's not for everybody. Some people don't need that.
I was hoping that you would leave this veil over me of not understanding some dark metaphor, like this is some Aronofsky film, like no, Mother, I don't think, or there's, something, where I'm like...
Maybe somebody would argue differently. I don't see a metaphor here at all. Everything here, yeah, I think, is literal action on the screen
what you get.
Story is what we're supposed to see. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think this might be my least favorite Fincher film.
Okay.
I'd have to do some looking up, but I'm just disappointed right now.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's made some good ones. It might be my least favorite.
I watched The Zodiac just to get hyped up for this film.
That's the problem right there.
Watching a good Fincher movie. Yeah,
expecting anything to live up to Zodiac. No, I know I'm on an island, but the only one probably competing with this is Seven. I don't think Seven's all that great, but...
Yeah, that's in my top 100.
No, I know.
You are on an island with that one, but I also understand why you don't like that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you think... No, I already forgot my train of thought for that one, so go ahead.
Okay. I want to talk about a couple of the performances. Tilda Swinton stepping in.
She's here.
Really liked that tete-a-tete. Found it interesting. That was the conversation where I started to become more aware of what I think the movie was trying to do. I was kind of confused up until that conversation. I was like, oh, I think I see what's going on here. But also that conversation had a couple of moments that my movie-going brain read a particular way that ended up absolutely not being anything. I expected a couple things to happen that the movie had no interest in happening. And that was, that's on me. That's not necessarily on the movie, but it did impact kind of that scene for me. But I really enjoyed the expert and the killer conversation. I thought that was good.
I kind of disagree with that just a little bit. I felt their conversation didn't lend anything. She was going on with this idiom or this joke about a bear and a hunter and stuff, and at the end of it, I'm like, so what do you mean by that?
It doesn't. I think I understood the metaphor there. I think I understood what she was talking about there.
Is it, correct me if I'm wrong, but okay, is it you're looking to self-punishment or something like that?
No, I think it's about self-contradiction. I think it's the theme of the movie. I think the idea is eventually the bear says, you're not really here for the hunting, are you? Right? Like, so that's the joke you're talking about. The idea is that she became aware at some point that the money that she was making wasn't actually the thing that the reason she kept coming back to it, that there was something about her that actually wanted to do the work, the disgusting, terrible work. And she's confronting him by saying, you know, maybe you need to do the same and understand. And he sees something in her that I think he envies, which is she, you know, enjoys things. She wishes, she had ice cream and whiskey, and like she seems to like. He talks about being confused at her living in the city, and like, how does she do? You can't do these things. So there's like an envy he has with that character that I think that story brings to light what he's missing that she has, which is she has admitted to herself the true narrative of who she is, whereas he is fighting his, you know, false narrative of who he thinks he is. I think is what's going on there. I'm kind of convincing myself to like this movie, by the way, the more I talk about it. Like, it seems like a really smart movie. I just get to the end of it and I'm just like, I don't know that the journey meant anything. I don't know that the destination was anything interesting for me. So,
yeah. And if it if by some miracle, I shouldn't say by some miracle, but if you do find out whatever this movie is about, please call and let me know what it's about. I don't care if it's 3 a.m. Andrew, I figured it out.
Let's see. Wanted to talk about Charles Parnell as well. Love Charles Parnell.
I swear I thought it said Chris Parnell whenever his name, because the credits went by really quick.
Yeah.
It was like Fassbender, Killer, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. I was like, Chris Parnell?
Yeah, and Carrie O'Malley as well. The Hodges and Dolores characters I thought were both really compelling. I even found Arliss Howard compelling as well. The actor, the last, you know, kind of the denouement of the movie. I don't know. I thought the performances were good.
That made me mad, and I'm going to teeter on spoilers here. Because now the movie made me mad because of who he decided to kill and who he decided to spare.
Mm-hmm. I think that's
really upset me.
I think that's intentional. Really upset. I think the movie wants you to be upset about that. I do. Yes.
Well, then mission accomplished. But I'm not. The movie wants me to be mad at the movie.
I don't know if it wants you to be mad at the movie, but it might. Certainly art can incite, you know, like there are many different reasons people make movies. But I think you're definitely supposed...
Fincher's a masochist.
Possibly. We haven't done a great job at not spoiling this movie. We've talked about a lot of details. Hopefully none of it will ruin it for you. It is a pretty straightforward kind of thing that's going on here, though. So, I don't feel like we're giving away any big twists or anything. But yeah, I also would be curious as to your thoughts if you loved this movie. What you took away from it when you came to the end, not just intellectually, not just, just watching it and going, you know, the things that we've talked about and things I've talked about that I found intellectually interesting. But that you came away from and go, oh, here's the point that, impacts how I see the world, or here's the worldview that was interesting, to me. And maybe it's as simple as I don't feel like I have that killer button in my brain. You know what I mean? Like, that's not so, like, I can't identify with this human being or any of these human beings. Andrew, maybe now is where you stay silent.
Okay.
No,
I don't know what the statute of limitations is on some. No, I'm joking. I'm joking, people.
Anything else you want to talk about the killer before we move on?
No post-credit scene.
That is true. That is true. All right, that'll finish up our discussion on David Fincher's The Killer. Still want to see another season of Mindhunter, even after seeing this. I'm really sad that we're not getting another season of Mindhunter. All right, let's move into our best ever challenge. But before we do, big thank you to our amazing SIFPOP members. Thank you for supporting what goes on here at the podcast and at the website. Really, really appreciate it. You can do that at patreon.com/SIFPOP. And there are some fun bonus things you get there. You can check all that out. We have a bonus podcast that you can subscribe to. You get your own feed. Lots of cool stuff. Again, that's at patreon.com/SIFPOP.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, best ever challenge, as mentioned, best ever killer movies. Movies with the a form of the word kill in the title. Kill, killer, killing, killers, kills.
Kiltacular.
Kiltacular.
Kiltrocity.
Yes, thank you. Yes, the Kiltacular Jonathan. I forgot about that movie. That's a pretty amazing one. All right, we'll go number 5 to number 1. If you have it higher, you can... so that you can talk about it when it's at its highest ranking. There are a few of these, but not necessarily a bunch that I wanted on my list. So I only have like a handful of these, but I did manage to get 5. I imagine there'll be some crossover. Andrew, why don't you go first? What's your number 5?
It's Kill a Mockingbird.
Trap!
I knew it.
Yeah, yeah.
What you got?
My number five is Natural Born Killers.
On my list of shame.
Oh, interesting. Speaking of movies that you're not going to feel good after watching, but are technically interesting. Natural Born Killers is one of those, and I think it should speak to the dearth of killer movies that I actually have this on my list. It's not one of my favorite movies, but it is a very well done film, and I do think belongs in the conversation. So I would be interesting to hear your thoughts if you ever get around to watching it.
It's the Woody Harrelson movie, right?
Oh, indeed it is.
Okay.
The Woody Harrelson movie. I was trying to remember. Why can't I remember who? Yeah, Juliette Lewis. Woody Harrelson and Juliette Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
Robert Downey Jr. is in there as well. Tommy Lee Jones, Tom Sizemore. It's a good cast. The story by Quentin Tarantino, in case you didn't know that.
Wow.
And he didn't write the screenplay, but the story is his. And then Oliver Stone directed it. So there's a reason it's technically great, but again, doesn't make you feel all that good. But yeah,
got a lot going for it.
Absolutely. All right, what's your number four?
Kill Bill 2.
Yep, go for it. Tell us about Kill Bill Volume 2.
Why did you have the first Kill Bill on
your list? We'll find out later, Andrew.
We'll find out, huh? Okay, yeah. I'm not the biggest fan of the Kill Bill films, but if I have to pick one, I like the second one mainly because at the very end you get that amazing Superman speech.
Sure.
From Bill,
yeah,
which is just dripping with beautiful metaphors about what it means. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what I was hoping we would get in the Tilda Swinton Michael Fassbender scene. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
That's what I was kind of hoping that we would get, some Superman speech here.
Yeah.
But I don't know why the Kill Bill movies don't speak to me like a lot of other Tarantino movies do, because I think a lot of the same stuff is going on here. They're very well-made movies.
Yeah. Yep. I have an interesting relationship to the Kill Bill movies. I'm not a big fan of a lot of Quentin Tarantino's earlier work, other than Jackie Brown, which I think is pretty astonishing. But I do have a soft spot in my heart for the Kill Bill movies, and I think it has to do with the humanity that Uma Thurman brings to that gory role. I think there's something about her performance of this revenge fantasy film that locks me into an empathy that other of his movies don't feel like they have for me. I just took all my conversation about another movie I'll talk about later. On to my number four. My number four is License to Kill, the James Bond movie, Dalton, right? Bond.
It is Dalton.
I did a James Bond watch over the last couple years and caught up on all the Bond films that I had missed. I was astonished by how much I liked Dalton. I think Dalton was a Daniel Craig prototype. I think there is a real interesting thing they tried to do with those movies, and I'm sad that he didn't get more. And I think License to Kill is a good example of that. So it's definitely one worth watching.
Benicio del Toro.
Yeah, right.
Quick cameo. Yeah. One of his first roles.
Absolutely. All right, what is your number three?
My number three is A Time to Kill.
Mine too. We share our number three. Go ahead, talk about
it. Nice. Just saw it for the first time yesterday.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm curious as to your thoughts. I also saw it, rewatched it fairly recently. So, yeah, what are some of your thoughts?
Thoroughly impressed. Did not expect it to be as good as it was. I thought I was going to get a run-of-the-mill court drama. No, this is a very, very well-done movie. There's a scene at the very end where Samuel L. Jackson and Matthew McConaughey are sitting in his jail cell. And McConaughey's like, I'm the only friend you have. And then Sam Jackson's like, we're not friends. We never would have hung out outside of this. Mm-hmm. I hired you because you're a white lawyer. And that whole thing at the very end, it just, oh man, this was such a good movie. I'm mad at myself for not having seen it earlier.
It's definitely,
I love Oliver Platt.
Yeah, Oliver Platt is so great in this movie. Matthew McConaughey, also really great in this movie. It's what, mid-90s, like 96, something like that. Yep. It's incredible to me how the texture of film has changed in the last 20 years. Well, I guess coming on 30 years since then. And what I mean by that is this movie plays very melodramatic now. The way the music is used, the way the cutting is used, the way the lines are said does not feel very modern. I don't think I hesitate to say it doesn't age well because that makes it sound like it's bad. It's just so different how these stories were told in the 90s than how they would be told now. And because of that, I did have rewatching it just kind of like, oh my goodness, this is like the subject matter is so dark and so terrible. And then for the movie to be like, yeehaw, we're the racist white guys, you know, like it's really just like, you know what I mean? Like it's very in your face. And I think modern movies deal a lot more in the subtle and nuance and those kind of things. And this movie is not interested in subtlety or nuance.
No, it's in your face.
Yeah,
for
it's
sure.
Very in your face. Having said that, I really like it. Have it at my number three here. So yeah, it's definitely worth a watch, even with those caveats. All right, number twos. What do you got at number two?
This is where I have The Killing Fields.
Talk about it. I don't know that I've seen this movie. If I have, I don't remember.
It's a rough one.
Yeah.
It is a rough... You would remember it because we were talking... you put it as your buried treasure a couple weeks ago. You said that you'd never seen a war movie that didn't glorify war until Grave of the Fireflies.
Right, yes.
I think that Grave of the Fireflies is the animated version of The Killing Fields, tonally.
Well, that sounds wonderful then. Excited.
Yes, exactly.
Excited to go through that eventually.
Yeah. Sam Waterston's amazing. Heeng Noir, who was he won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. This movie won a whole bunch of Oscars, I think. But yeah, it's about Cambodia, the country of Cambodia during Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And if you're not familiar, Cambodia was heavily like obliterated during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And it's all about the atrocities that happened over there. And it's about a journalist who's trying to, you know, capture all of this Cambodia war. But then his, I don't know what they're called, when you have a journalist that's in country that you're there to meet up with, a liaison, I guess it would be.
Okay.
But the liaison goes missing, and it's all about trying to find this guy in the middle of this war.
Yeah. It sounds like one I should check out at some point. So, yeah. The Killing Fields for your number two. My number two is Kill Bill Volume 1. I prefer Volume 1 to Volume 2, but it is only slightly. And I already kind of talked about why I have a place in my heart for these movies. And yeah, it's wild. I also feel like, you know, as much as I talk about how my pacifism impacts my ability to understand violence, I will take the samurai violence over gun violence any day because my brain processes it as more of an art form or a cartoon, or whereas the other, and again, we're dealing with another mass shooting within the last, you know, few days in Maine, you know, gun violence in movies, just I'm having a harder and harder time being entertained by it. But with something like that's swords and martial arts and those kind of things, it works a little bit better, for me. So yeah, there's, it's an interesting contradiction to be human, but yeah, I do think the Kill Bill movies, do something that a lot of the other early Quentin movies don't do for me.
Aaron, you contradict yourself all you want. I won't call you out on it.
Thanks. I appreciate it. All right, let's do our number ones. What is your number one?
I have a documentary, actually, for my number one. The Act of Killing. It is about, if I can get my phone to work, sorry. I had everything written down.
You're totally fine.
So The Act of Killing, it's a documentary about this Indonesian death squad. And the leaders of it reenact mass killings. So you see like these actual like old, like 70 and 80 year old men now who are reminiscing about like, oh yeah, I remember this time when we went into this village and we slaughtered everybody. But what makes this documentary fascinating is it follows these guys around, and then inevitably for each of them, there comes a moment where they have a self-actualization of what they've done. Mm. And they like, wait, like, I'm an evil man. I've murdered millions of hundreds of people.
Yeah.
And one of these guys just breaks down and just starts vomiting because he's so like shocked with how he, with, like, this is how people felt. Like, this is how people felt whenever I was killing them.
Right.
It's a very powerful documentary. It came out 2012, I believe. Very, very powerful. Not an easy watch though.
That is called The Act of Killing. Is that what it's called?
Yes. The Act of Killing.
The Act of Killing, in at number one for Andrew. If you've been paying attention.
Either won or was nominated to an Oscar for Best Documentary.
Nice. If you've been paying attention, you know my number one. It is To Kill a Mockingbird. I think this movie is important. I think this movie is well done. And I think Gregory Peck is amazing in it. So yeah, wanted to give a shout out to Kill a Mockingbird. Which I also saw recently on Broadway with Jeff Daniels, and thought that was amazing. Yes. So, yeah.
I bet that was so good.
It was so very good. Written by Aaron Sorkin, starring Jeff Daniels, right in front of me on stage. Seriously. Let's go. That was a great experience. And the movie is good as well. And these older movies sometimes, I think, slip through the cracks. 1962, that was a long time ago, but the stuff that this movie is dealing with, unfortunately, still relevant in many ways. Check it out. To Kill a Mockingbird is my number one. I did have one honorable mention before we get to our honorable mentions. What did the SIFPOP gurus say over at SIFPOP.com?
So the gurus had at number three, License to Kill.
Mm-hmm.
So they got some James Bond love in there.
Nice.
Glad to see that. Then the first Kill Bill, Volume 1.
Nice.
And then number one was To Kill a Mockingbird. Well, so they had...
matches my list, basically.
You're pretty much your list.
Just got to sneak a Time Good to job. Kill in there. The only honorable mention I had was Dressed to Kill, the De Palma movie. It's one of his early movies, and... De Palma's an acquired taste, and this movie is quite an acquired taste, but he is... It's like he's trying to channel Alfred Hitchcock sometimes. And it's so interesting to see how he chooses to tell these stories. So Dressed to Kill is very interesting. Andrew, did you have any honorable mentions?
Like you said earlier, it was a very sparse list. Mm-hmm. So nothing that I was really excited to shout out.
Okay.
We had one guru, I'm not going to say who, but they said, fight me. I'm shouting out Halloween Kills.
Nope. No honorable mention for Halloween Kills on this podcast. I'm sorry, unfortunately. All right. Before we finish off, Andrew, let's do some buried treasure. What's that one thing in any area of pop culture that you want to make sure people know about? I'll start us off. Recently watched all the way through. I don't know that I'd ever really sat down and just watched this movie. Certainly not recently. 8 Men Out, 1988 movie about the Black Sox scandal, about the guys who took money to lose in the World Series.
With John Cusack, right?
Yep, John Cusack, Charlie Sheen, David Strathairn, D.B. Sweeney, Christopher Lloyd, Michael Rooker, John Sayles. Great cast, really interesting story. And a little bit of nuance there. Great performances. I think this may be the best John Cusack has been. He's so good in this movie. I also really like John Mahoney as the coach in this movie. I think he's perfect. Lots of really, really great scenes, really interesting stuff. Sports movie, court movie. It's all of the above. And it's really worth a watch. So that is 8 Men Out, if you want to check it out. Andrew, what is your buried treasure?
Well, I'm glad you said that you don't find sword violence gratuitous as opposed to gun violence, because that's what my next movie is.
Nice.
I think I may have done this as a buried treasure before, so if I have, I apologize to everybody, but it's been so long that it should be for a fresh new audience then. The movie is called 13 Assassins. basically, it's a true story. A group of assassins come together for a suicide mission to kill an evil lord. This takes place in pseudo Japan. This lord who was terrorizing a whole bunch of villages, he was about to be elected to a higher position of power to where he could do more damage to people. So 13 Ronin decided, you know what, we're going to dishonor ourselves for the sake of the people. We were going to go and try and kill this guy. And it turned out that he had an escort of over 200 people. So it's kind of like 300, you know, many against few. But this is also like 300, a true story that is highly exaggerated. So if you go in and you just realize that, yeah, he was assassinated, but probably not how it's portrayed in this movie. Great acting. It is incredibly violent. So that would be my only content warning for it. It is sword violence. So lots of limbs and stuff like that.
Okay. This is the 2010 13 Assassins, Takashi Miike directing.
Yes.
Okay.
That's him.
Very cool. That
very good. You can watch it on Hulu.
Yeah, 13 Assassins is on Hulu. 8 Men Out is on Prime if you want to check out the buried treasure from this week. Well, we did it, Andrew. We managed to do a podcast.
Oh my gosh. I'm so proud of us.
We did it without murdering anyone.
we left that to everybody else.
Thank you so much for joining us today for Sif Pop. It is part of the Studio DNA Podcast Network. You can find out more about other shows on the network at studiodna.media or by searching Studio DNA in your podcast player. Huge thanks to Andrew for hanging out today.
Well, thanks, buddy.
Big thanks to producer Phil for producing the audio and video show.
Thanks, Phil.
Much love and gratitude to our Sif Pop members for giving monthly to make Sif Pop a real thing. That starts at $3 a month. If you want to check it out, it's at patreon.com/SifPop. You can also connect with us by leaving a comment, a rating, or a review at Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen. And finally, if you're having a good time, your movie-loving friends will probably like the show too. So make sure you let them know about it and that listening is much easier than actually finding all the wolves in the picture. We'll be back next time with Anatomy of a Fall. And maybe Priscilla? I haven't exactly decided yet. A couple of awards contenders coming out this week. But we'll get back with you some reviews next time we're here. Bye.
Bye.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Save big money now on new siding from LP Smart Side at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP Smart Side today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big.